Hello, everybody, and welcome back to another episode of The Damage Report. I am Johnny Rolo. We've got an absolutely massive show for you in studio. The first time on The Damage Report,
yes.
Nayor Hawk.
Hello, everybody. Good to be here. Glad to
have you here. You've been on the network before.
I have.
First time on the show.
Mm-hmm.
And you've come in tumultuous times. and by that, I mean any time after mid-2015.
Yes. Any week, pick a week.
Exactly. Infrastructure week, I call it. We've got a lot of the news. We've got some updates on an averted act of domestic terrorism. Thankfully, he was stopped. We're gonna talk about that and the political implications around that. We're gonna return to one of our favorites in media, Tucker Carlson, and an interaction he had with a historian that did not quite go his way, but he did perhaps make history in his own way. We're gonna close out the show, if we have time, with a discussion about the potential role of trolls in the Democratic primary. Apparently, they've already spooled up their engines and they're getting involved. And along the way, we have two awesome guests who are gonna be joining us. So in just a little bit, in the next block, Brianna Joy Gray from The Intercept is gonna be joining us to talk about the sort of legacy of the scandal around Ralph Northam, as well as some narratives of race in the Democratic primary. Later on in the show, former NFL wide receiver and entrepreneur Walter Powell Jr. is gonna join us in studio to debut his new Political Transparency Act app, Politiscope, which I've had a chance to use and it is awesome. And as soon as I started using, I thought, why didn't this exist already? So that should be a lot of fun as well. So let's get to, why don't we jump in the news?
Let's go right ahead.
Thankfully, someone who aimed to be the next big domestic terrorist was stopped. This is a Coast Guard lieutenant and self-described white nationalist who had been apparently stockpiling both weapons and white nationalist literature. And thankfully, he was stopped. Now, we have some details about what he intended to do. Court filing argued that he should be held until he's tried, describing him as a, quote, domestic terrorist who intended to, quote, murder innocent civilians on a scale rarely seen in this country. And that is not an exaggeration. In his writings, he wrote, I am dreaming of a way to kill almost every last person on the earth. I think a plague would be most successful, but how do I acquire the needed Spanish flu, botulism, anthrax? Not sure yet, but we'll find something. I think it's probably a controversial position to take as a white supremacist that you intend to kill every white person on the planet as well, but kudos to him for thinking outside of the white supremacist box, I guess.
And it's actually not unique to him. There's a very fascinating report that the Anti-Defamation League released about 2019. All of the extremist attacks were every single one was a right-wing terrorist.
2018, but
for 2018,
yes.
Right. I mean, like just looking at the last year. And usually we only see that under Democratic presidents, right? It's like there's a rise of the right wing because they say, oh, they're anti-government and this can work. Mm. I think it's fascinating that this rise in right-wing terror is happening under Donald Trump, who was essentially one of theirs. He's their guy. So they clearly seem to be getting some kind of signal that targeting minorities and raising the white supremacy flag is going to be welcome in this administration.
100%. I just saw, I think yesterday, hate groups in the past couple of years have increased by 30%, the formation of new groups and all of that. And yeah, that is amazing though, because like we experienced the first days of Barack Obama's first term when the Tea Party, they were really interested in deficits. And so that's why they developed. A lot of white conservatives felt like we've lost the country, they've taken over it. But the amazing thing about Donald Trump is he came in with unified Republican control, a conservative Supreme Court, and they still feel like they're the victims, they're the downtrodden, let's take everything back, and they lash out. And you know, I mean, look, there are historical examples of this sort of thing. None of them are positive. And this guy perhaps fits into that tradition.
And it's also fascinating that somehow he became an officer. Right? This is not something that was screened out in the process of having to be in the military, which is one of the forefronts of social integration in American history. So like of all the places, you're a guy who has to serve with fellow officers who are black, Hispanic, potentially gay. I mean, all sorts of different issues. So very interesting that this is how it came up. I will say, I don't think we should be looking at him as the poor, unfortunate, what went wrong guy. This is he did this and was thinking of doing all of this while serving our country and wearing the country's uniform, taking an oath on the Constitution. So he should be held accountable to the full extent of the law.
Oh, 100%. I have no interest in any lone wolf. Oh, mental health. Like,
if women rejected him at some point in his life, that's not an excuse for what you were trying to do here.
Exactly. No, he is a right-wing white nationalist, apparently, and I'll make the case, but I think Trump inspired in some of his violence domestic terrorists, an aspiring domestic terrorist on a scale that we've perhaps never seen before.
And at minimum has called them very fine people.
Exactly.
At minimum, it's made it socially okay to be a fine person and be taking tiki torches heading towards a black church.
Yeah. Yeah, and let me just get out in front and say that if it turns out that this is some sort of elaborate hoax that he created, we'll return to that if it happens. It seems like there's a lot
of
evidence here.
And also, find a better hoax.
Exactly, yes. Yeah, he had 15 assault rifles, shotguns, handguns, more than 1,000 rounds of ammunition. He had been stockpiling food. No word yet on disaster seeds, but perhaps he had some of those as well. Let's talk a little bit about what he aimed to do specifically. We have the general view. Let's zoom in now. So let's be really clear about the white nationalist stuff. He both says that he wanted a white homeland in the Pacific Northwest. I've got news for you, buddy. That is already kind of a white homeland. I don't know how much more white you can make the Pacific Northwest. But obviously, there's serious implications there because that would involve culling out everyone who is not white. He wanted to start a race war. He said much blood will have to be spilled to get whitey off the couch. Many of his compatriots in the white supremacist movement would probably be highly offended by the term whitey, but that's what he used. And let's talk about who he aimed to take down. So he used his work computer to draw up a list of prominent figures he called traitors and wanted to kill, including anchors and hosts on so-called liberal news networks and a number of elected Democrats. So we've got Nancy Pelosi, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, Maxine Waters, Richard Blumenthal, who he called Senator Blumenjew. I don't know why he didn't just go into comedy. Like, why waste your time in the Coast Guard? And many of the senators running for president in 2020. So look, Cesar Sayoc had the full targets list drawn from the greatest fantasies that Donald Trump has ever had of who he would go after. This guy's doing the same thing. I mean, Nancy Pelosi, AOC, Maxine Waters.
I also don't think it's a fantasy target list. These are people that the president attacks on Twitter on a pretty regular basis, right?
Specifically,
this is the first president that we've had who has targeted individuals himself directly using a public platform who have dared to present a counterpoint of view.
And has specifically threatened them in his language, like Maxine Waters. So let's say, look, Nancy Pelosi's the leader of the Democrats. If you hate the Democrats, maybe you just hate Nancy Pelosi. That makes sense. She's the leader or whatever. Richard Blumenthal, no, you hate him specifically because Donald Trump has been targeting him. So this guy got stopped.
Why do you hate AOC?
Why do you hate AOC? I mean, I'm assuming he hates her because she's vivacious and young
and
probably
fun,
the
and
dance.
She can dance.
She represents all of the lost potential of his and others' lives. I feel it every time I look at her. Look at what I could have accomplished. No, I couldn't have. That's the only consolation I have, is that even if I'd tried, I would have failed.
Even if I tried, I would not be a congresswoman from the Bronx. It's just not in my cards.
I would not be. Yeah. Well, I would have less of a chance. but let's return to Richard Blumenthal. If this guy had successfully assassinated Richard Blumenthal, is there any case to be made that that would not have been specific provocation from the president? I know I'm a crazy leftist, implying that the president is responsible for—
I think words matter. Yeah, like, how dare you imply that the president is responsible for his words and actions and people taking his signal as a leader of this country, right? I mean, this just, you need skepticism in these times. This is why you need fact-checking and why you need some kind of rational debate, because this is what happens when you take the leader at his words, when his words are, I mean, they're
vile. Very specific.
Very specific, they are vile and they are hateful.
Yeah. And so let's turn to the media a little bit. He apparently had a problem with a number of different hosts on fake news CNN and MSNBC. He performed internet searches for Joe Scarborough, among others, and for the phrase, quote, civil war if Trump impeached. So look, obviously the president hates Joe Scarborough. He doesn't tweet about him much anymore, but he used to. Apparently that search was done after a mention of Joe Scarborough by Trump. So again, there seems to be a pretty direct link there. Civil war if Trump impeached, that, look, to some extent, Donald Trump is saying the investigation of his campaign is illegal and treasonous. Yep. So theoretically, if Mueller came out with something that looked really bad, if you believe that this entire thing was treasonous, it would be your duty as a patriot to overthrow our government and civil war and all of that. But this is also being buttressed every night by Sean Hannity and by, you know, whack jobs like Alex Jones, who are, they're out there prepping for civil war themselves on video.
Yep.
Sean Hannity is saying this entire thing is illegitimate. So if it is illegitimate, then why wouldn't patriots, you know, members of our armed services. Why would they not be preparing for this sort of stuff? And so I would lay some of the culpability on media figures like that as well.
Specifically when their commander in chief is giving them these signals. That's the difference, right? The generals are not saying any of this. The generals are trying to avoid any type of dissent in the ranks and try to keep it a cohesive unit. So he's not getting this from the active duty leadership who actually care about the impact of words on war, in diplomacy especially. They're getting this from the commander in chief, and that's dangerous precedent for Donald Trump to be setting.
I 100% agree. And thank God this guy was stopped. I mean, look, we know that this is not the only issue. Like, we don't have time to go into it, unfortunately. But you know, white nationalism and extremism in the armed forces is a well-documented thing. I wouldn't have expected it in the Coast Guard specifically, but it needs to be investigated. We need to figure out if people are planning.
And
you know,
the key part of this is that under Donald Trump, he shut down the Department of Justice unit that was focusing on the rise in white nationalist terror. This is Jeff Sessions under him. This was part of their effort to really erase this as part of what the government is tracking and concerned about, and focus instead on what they call, you know, radical Islamists or black communities. So this is not a even-handed effort to fix the country. It is very specifically focused. This Department of Justice is focused on communities of color at the expense of a rising threat to all of us.
100%. Yeah, get rid of the people who would investigate it and then point people in the right direction. Mm-hmm. The only question at this point is he intentionally creating these acts, or is it just, you know, consequence of his buffoonery and all of that? I leave that to you. With that, though, we do have to take a break. When we come back, Breonna Gray is going to be joining us to talk about some issues surrounding the primary and also Ralph Northam after this.
We need to talk about a relatively new show called the Republic, or UNFTR. As a Young Turks fan, you already know that the government, the media, and corporations are constantly peddling lies that serve the interests of the rich and powerful. But now there's a podcast dedicated to unraveling those lies, debunking the conventional wisdom. In each episode of the Republic, or UNFTR, the host delves into a different historical episode or topic that's generally misunderstood or purposely obfuscated by the so-called powers that be, featuring in-depth research, razor-sharp commentary, and just the right amount of vulgarity. The UNFTR podcast takes a sledgehammer to what you thought you knew about some of the nation's most sacred historical cows. But don't just take my word for it. The New York Times described UNFTR as consistently compelling and educational, aiming to challenge conventional wisdom and upend the historical narratives that were taught in school. For as the great philosopher Yoda once put it,
"You must unlearn what you have learned."
And that's true whether you're in Jedi training or you're uprooting and exposing all the propaganda and disinformation you've been fed over the course of your lifetime. So search for UNFDR in your podcast app today and get ready to get informed, angered, and entertained all at the same time.
Joining us now on The Damage Report, senior politics editor for The Intercept, Breonna Joy Gray. Breonna, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Glad to have you here. We've been wanting to talk to you for quite some time, and we've got a couple of topics that I can't wait to drill down into with you. First, Ralph Northam, we're a couple of weeks out from the breaking of his scandals surrounding his use of blackface at least once in his past. And it kind of seems like he slipped through, and he's not going to step down, and consequences seem slight, if at all. What is your take on this? Do you think that he has largely avoided any sort of responsibility or consequences for this?
It seems like it. I mean, polls were showing that a majority of African Americans in the state actually did not want him to resign. And I think that the part of the problem here is that the choices being set up are overly binary. You know, I wrote an article in which I suggested that the issue shouldn't be whether or not he resigns, but whether or not he is able and, in fact, does follow through on acts of actual repenting, right? And that repentance comes before absolution. I think in a lot of these conversations, you end up having to choose between canceling someone outright and accepting them as they are. And the conversation about what actually constitutes a apology, which actually is meaningful and actually makes the distinction between who the person is today and who they were then, is lost. And that's why a lot of people feel unfulfilled either way the outcome manifests.
Yeah, and I found the nuance in your piece to be a great addition to this conversation, lost in most of the discussion around it. So let's talk about your analysis of potential repentance and atonement. In a case like this, what could that look like?
So Northam says he's going on this apology tour. He doesn't call it an apology tour, he calls it a reconciliation tour. And the first stop of that tour was supposed to be today, except it was canceled by the students who preferred that he not come to this event, which was honoring, I believe, people who had participated in a sit-in to desegregate in the 1960s. I think that this is a really great example of the kind of event that actually isn't especially helpful. I understand why students might have chosen to ask him not to come, because at the end of the day, this is a place this was a circumstance in which he was being asked, or which students were trying to honor people who had, you know, participated and been furthered civil rights interests in the past. This isn't necessarily a place for him to come and have a conversation about his own personal failings.
Yeah.
I think that the idea that he is going to be newly exposed to the reality of racial injustice in the past and that that is going to change his mind is a bit naive. The issue isn't that he is completely ignorant about civil rights struggles or the history of racial inequality in this country, is that he needs to participate in more conversations about how that kind of discrimination manifests today and why exactly it is that people are uncomfortable with someone who has done so little reckoning, having so much control over the fates of a largely Black, very diverse population in Virginia.
Brianna, I really appreciate your conversation that you're raising about nuance. And there seems to be a different nuance in the Attorney General's apology for a similar circumstance. Can you talk to us a little bit about how that's translated locally versus the Northam apology tour?
Yeah, I think that there was, first and foremost, a kind of unequivocal acceptance of what he had done. Part of what was so frustrating about Northam's apology was that it was followed by kind of a retraction where he says, well, I'm not actually in the picture, although I did darken my face on another occasion to dress up as Michael Jackson, and it kind of blurred the waters. The first step has to be an unequivocal acceptance and acknowledgement of what it is that you had done, which we did get with the Attorney General's apology. There also seemed to be a greater understanding of why it is that blackface is bad, which is something that I think even the media has failed to cover with sufficient detail. And I wanted to take the time of my article to try to help people to understand that even if Northam wasn't dressed in kind of stereotypical blackface, the kind of blackface that we associate with the particularly craven vaudevillian acts that was making an express mockery of African Americans, even if he was, you know, just, and I put that in quotation marks, dressed as a pop singer, that is still bad. And the idea that he kind of put that forward as though that was, that absolved him, at least substantially absolved him of his crimes, was really short-sighted and speaks to the fact that he doesn't understand that even if you don't, I do think it's less bad, but the point of the matter is that you are ignoring the historical legacy or ignorant of the historical legacy of that worst kind of blackface, which is why dressing as even Black famous people carries such a negative social valence.
And so I want to talk a little bit more about things that he might not understand, because the act that he's alleged to have done, the, you know, appearing in blackface at that point, what he definitely did, which is using that picture in his yearbook and admitting that he had done blackface, some people will say, well, that's a while ago. But on CBS, I mean, he called slaves indentured servants, which sort of implies that there is not just historic ignorance, there is lingering ignorance up until a couple of weeks ago.
Yeah, that was certainly pretty disappointing. Look, in a lot of ways, I think that the inclusion of the photograph in the yearbook is one of the most galling aspects of this, because it speaks to the broader institutional and structural acceptance of this kind of behavior. And in fact, there were a couple of stories that followed that where people had found similar images in other yearbooks, which really speaks to the fact that we are talking about a much larger cultural problem than just Northam. Now, that cuts both ways. The fact that this is, in fact, a cultural problem says that punishing Northam as an individual isn't really getting to the bottom of this. There is a world in which we end up with all of the people who simply have photographic evidence of their bad deeds are dismissed, and everyone who was kind of savvy enough to keep it under the radar gets to hold office and is never like forced to reckon with their past deeds. I think that this really does present an interesting opportunity to dialogue with someone who we know, because of photographic evidence, has transgressed in the past, but is in a position to actually have the tough conversations about what it means, like why racism matters, that are very infrequently actually had publicly.
Yeah. We don't have much time, unfortunately. There's so much I want to talk to you about. I did want to ask you at least one question about some topics in the news right now. And that has to do with, we're right into the thick of the Democratic primary already, even though it's February. And already we have a massive field that is diverse in both racial and gender terms in ways that past Democratic fields have not been. And that has already begun to raise certain topics of how that will play into the selection of a candidate. What do you think about the way that that is likely to play out over the course of the next year?
You know, I think that all candidates need to kind of respect and appreciate what it means to a lot of Americans to be represented in politics. Historically, it has been a kind of a neat and easy proxy to see if a candidate is going to best represent your interests, particularly when there were so few diverse candidates at play. Unfortunately, there has also been a kind of a cynical way in which that the desire for diversity, the genuine desire for diversity, has been manipulated as kind of a way to cover for candidates whose policies aren't necessarily structured to benefit those groups as much as candidates who might be more progressive but not as diverse. And I think it's going to be really important to highlight that as much as identity is an understandable benefit and an understandable draw for a lot of voters, that identity doesn't mean much if not paired with the underlying policy goals of a candidate. And it will be incumbent on the press to make those distinctions clear, although I'm not necessarily optimistic that a mainstream press will do so.
Well, they might not, but at least on the debate front, we have more debates than I can remember, you know, in any past primary. So there's going to be a lot of time for candidates to set themselves apart in terms of policy and things like that. I wish we had more time. Hopefully we can return to this topic as the primary develops. But Brianna, thank you so much for joining us.
Absolutely. My pleasure.
We're going to take just a short break. When we come back, Tucker Carlson recently went head to head with a Dutch historian on the topic of tax rates, wealth inequality. And we're going to evaluate how exactly he did after this. Over the past month or so, since his big debut at the Davos, Rutger Bregman, who's a Dutch historian, his critique of wealth inequality, of the opposition amongst the world's elite to taxation, the lack of conversation around that, has really taken over part of the conversation about these issues. And he was actually invited onto Tucker Carlson to debate these issues. Now, you didn't see that interview because it was pre-taped and pulled. And you're gonna find out very soon why. Here's the first interaction between Rutger and Tucker in the pre-taped interview.
You are a millionaire funded by billionaires. That's what you are. And I'm glad you now finally jumped the bandwagon, you know, of people like Bernie Sanders and AOC. But you're not part of the solution, Mr. Carlson. You're part of the problem, actually.
AOC, wait, can I just say, and
It's true, right? That all the anchors on Fox, they're all millionaires. How is this possible? Well, it's very easy. You're just not talking about certain things.
Fox doesn't even play where you are.
It doesn't play where you are. Well, have you heard of the internet? I can watch things whatever I want, you know? I have, actually. I can't say I'm a great fan of your show, but I do my homework when you invite me on your show. So, I mean, you're probably not going to air this.
Okay, so stick a pin in the him saying I doubt that he's going to air it. But so that was like a couple of minutes into their talk, and he didn't really pull any punches.
No.
Yeah.
you would think that Tucker would have been prepared for this line of attack, knowing that this he's invited somebody on his show who is violently against the idea of millionaires and billionaires being best positioned to solve the world's problems. I mean, he literally went to the heart of their big conference in Davos to tell the billionaires directly, you all flow here on private jets. Like, you might want to think about what you're contributing to climate change. You may be part of the problem, especially since you're all evading how to pay taxes to solve these problems.
Yeah.
So if you invited that guy on your show, you should be aware, like you said, that he's going to do his research a little bit.
I agree. And it seemed like, I mean, Tucker, I think, revealed why he fell into the trap that he did. He apparently believed that Rucker Bregman wouldn't be familiar with him and wouldn't know who he is and wouldn't know that he's the personal heir to a fortune and is, you know, a millionaire and all of that. He said, Fox doesn't even play where you are, which to me sounds like, but how do you know my weakness? It's the internet. He's a historian. You know what historians do? Research. They look into things, and it appears as he did.
And they fact check things too. This also is a big blind spot, I think, for not just Tucker Carlson but most right wing folks, in which they think that the rest of the world really doesn't pay attention, and these are only and exclusively domestic conversations we have. This is a global challenge, and they like to toss around the word a globalist, and it's a weird anti-Semitic dog whistle that they do. But really, they're trying to avoid the fact that the United States has responsibilities for what it's contributing on the world stage and what's contributing to the global conversation.
I agree. Now, that video wasn't the actual climax of the conversation, but we turn to that now.
I went to Davos to speak truth to power, and I'm doing exactly the same thing right now. You might not like it, but you're a millionaire funded by billionaires, and that's the reason why you're not talking about these issues.
But I am talking about this issue.
Yeah, only now. Come on, you jumped the bandwagon. You're all like, oh, I'm against the globalist elite, blah, blah, blah. It's not very convincing, to be honest.
Why don't you go f*** yourself, you tiny brain, and I hope this gets picked up, because you're a moron. I tried to give you a hearing, but you were too f***ing annoying for me.
You can't handle the criticism, can you?
He's one of the, he comes from the school of the facts don't care about your feelings, I guess.
Very thin-skinned. Right?
It's
your show. You could at least engage with the guy and be like, huh, that's actually a very interesting point that you have there. Mm-hmm. And leave it at that. So many ways to diplomatically handle it. But again, this is not the personality that Tucker Carlson has. It's certainly not the personality of the president of the United States, who takes Tucker Carlson's lead.
Yes.
And all of them are just very highly emotional in their reactions to everything. And if they don't like you, you will not get a fair hearing, which is what ended up happening with this historian.
Yeah, and look, I know that Tucker Carlson's supposed to be a great debater or whatever. Everyone on the right's supposed to be a great debater. But you saw when Rucker's like, that's why you don't talk about these issues, because you're funded by Bill. Billionaires. There's like a pause of 4 seconds, and Tucker Carlson comes back with, "Yeah, I do." Okay, give a counterpoint. When Rucker says that you're just bandwagoning, that it's ridiculous for you to assert that you actually want to change the structural issues that have led to the economic system that we have right now, and your response is, "You're a tiny brain and you're annoying." No, say, here's what I was talking about a year ago. Here's what I was talking about 5 years ago. You've been on the media forever. If you have a track record in this area, describe it to the man.
Or try to appeal to the fact that the Republican Party for many years was and used to be the party of fiscal conservatism, right? Mm. It's supposed to be the party that is about giving tax breaks to working class. So at least give due credence to some of the rhetoric that your party has done. Mm-hmm. And it just goes to show how far away the Tucker Carlson's and the right wing are from what were traditional conservative policies and principles, and how just all in they are in the cult of personality,
exactly.
Including their own.
Yeah, it's sort of a balancing of deferring to Trump, but also trying to build your own brand in this new supposedly populist way. This went viral all over the place. People are criticizing Tucker Carlson. Obviously, this is a Christian Bale performance from him right there, just losing his mind. So he responded, and here is his explanation for why they did not air that interview.
But then he claimed that my corporate masters tell me what to say on this show, and that was too much. Whatever my faults or those of this channel, nobody in management has ever told us what positions to take on the air. Never, not one time. We have total freedom here, and we're grateful for that. I've hosted shows on both the other cable channels, so I know firsthand how rare that freedom is. On this show, thanks to Fox, we get to say exactly what we think is true, for better or worse. But there was no convincing Rucker Bregman of that. He knew what he knew. So I did what I try hard never to do on this show, and I was rude. I called him a moron, and then I modified that word with a vulgar Anglo-Saxon term that is also intelligible in Dutch. In my defense, I would say that that was entirely accurate, but you're not allowed to use that word on television. So once I'd said it out loud, there was no airing the segment. As it turns out, Bregman taped our exchange. He released the audio today, and if you like, you can listen to it. There is some profanity, and I apologize for that. On the other hand, it was genuinely heartfelt. I meant it with total sincerity.
Yeah, yeah, maybe you meant that with total sincerity, but what we just watched, no sincerity there. So they pre-taped this interview. He swore, he tried really hard not to. You could hear him trying hard not to.
That's what he was trying hard not to do, was swearing, right? He wasn't
totally
trying very hard to avoid the fact that he'd been caught like flat-footed with no argument and counterpoint
exactly
to what the guy was saying.
Yeah, so I mean, I think a lot, I came up with a solution. A lot of people came up with pretty fast. You could have bleeped out the swear. That's easy
and
to
it's
do.
Not
it's
like
pre-taped.
They also clearly don't know how to edit anything.
Yeah,
because they've never
out
edited footage to look a certain way or to cut it to make someone look
exactly
good. I found very interesting though that he said, "Oh, so what I still feel that," and what he felt was right versus
mm-hmm
any factual analysis.
Yeah.
I felt like he was a moron. I felt like he was a tiny brain. Versus, you clearly invited him on your show because you were trying to agree with him
mm-hmm
at the time and create this image that you are against the elites and that you too believe that billionaires, you know, you shouldn't be beholden to billionaires. So fascinating how he tried to turn that to his own advantage.
Exactly, and the overall argument, I didn't air it because I made an oopsie and swore. We showed you the video. Earlier in the interview, he'd already said he doubted he was going to air it, and it was because of the disagreement between them. So any reputation that he has tried to develop for bringing on people who disagree and giving them a fair shake and a fair airing, get rid of that. Any argument that he's the logic and facts guy, he's just straight down the middle, no emotion, no, he blows up if you question him.
And that's that Fox News is as how much, however much they claim that it's freedom for the host, it's a very particular definition and lane of freedom of thinking.
Yeah, and certainly less freedom for the guests. By the way, if you don't want to air the interview, don't air the interview. I think that adversarial interviews like that are largely a complete waste of time.
Mm-hmm.
But be honest about why you're not airing it. Don't try to pretend that it's because you slipped up and dropped an F-bomb. With that, we do have to take a break. When we come back, we're going to have a guest in studio to describe an awesome new app you're going to want to find out about after this. Joining us now in studio, an exciting guest to detail an exciting app that could make a big impact on the upcoming election, Walt Powell Jr.
Hey, how you doing?
How's it going?
Going good, man. Just feeling good.
And I'm feeling good too because I've been using your app, Politiscope,
mm-hmm,
and we want to talk about it now. So Politiscope, it's a political transparency app.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me about it.
So Politiscope is a objective player profile app for politics where it breaks down and explains every bill a politician votes for or against in the layman's terms, showcasing all notable articles and videos based off straight facts and just trying to bring transparency, you know, to this world because everybody looking for it, so
mm-hmm,
yeah.
And there's a lot of misinformation. There's
all
a lot of emotion.
Right.
There's a lot of tribalism and partisanship. And you're seeing some of the pages on the app right now. So let's talk about how you got in this. So you're formerly wide receiver in the NFL.
Mm-hmm.
You're an entrepreneur and businessman now.
Mm-hmm.
How did you go from just the idea to creating an app that you're seeing now that you can download it right now? You can use it. How did that process go?
So the process started, you know, in me and my co-founder Jackson Weiss' living room last December. Jay, he's always been politically savvy, a political junkie, and he's always been that person I've just went to for just any political information. So it was one day a bill got passed, and he was breaking it down to me, and we were just having a discussion how naive and misinformed people can be when it comes to politics, including me. And it literally, like, just hit me as clear as day and, like, the vision of Politiscope, and I'm like, Jay, what if we created an app that, like, broke down politics the way you break it down to me? So we were, you know, looking online, trying to see if there was an app similar to what we were thinking about, and couldn't find anything, so I told Jay, I said, I'll be right back. You know, went to CVS, grabbed some pen and paper,
mm-hmm,
shoot, came back home, drew it out exactly how I seen it, and it had Jay put in his political input, and 20-some pages later, it was Politiscope. So, you know, thankfully, all my 4 years and playing in the NFL, you know, I did a lot of networking just because, you know, you never know when your time is up in football. And, you know, thank God I was able to just reach back to those people, you know, ask them for just suggestions and what they thought about the app. So it just a few months later, ended up raising $500,000 for the app and starting our company and just been growing from there.
Yeah, which is amazing and in a very short period of time. So the thing is that there are apps that are political.
Yeah.
But they're not necessarily reliable and trustworthy, objective. Mm-hmm. So when you talk about, like, let's say somebody downloads this app, they boot it up, they want to look at legislation or possibly politicians, what sorts of information can they get about those things in the app?
So for instance, if you click on a politician's profile page, you'll have all the legislation they voted for, against, their bio, their contact information, and their media. And contact information also includes their Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, YouTube, anything. You can follow them all through the app as well. And you know, you can just get updated on anything they're doing when you follow them, as well as on any piece of legislation, any policies. We have it's just super in-depth with the breakdowns, and as well, we show the statistics of the vote breakdowns left to right, as well as who voted on them as well, who voted yes or no. Mm-hmm. And you can follow them as well. And even in our hot topics section, we showcase just all the hot topics ranging from education, environment, drug policy. And in there, you can really just see, you know, let's say you click on drug policy and you just want to watch videos for the day. We got all the videos of drug policy. Or if you just feel like reading all the bills, read all the bills, and same with articles. So just really just trying to just make it easy for everybody, because not everybody likes all the topics. And some people just, you know, just want to see drug policy, and that's all they want to go to. So, yeah.
Yeah, and not everybody, like, I pay attention to politics as much as pretty much anyone. But I don't necessarily know when let's say I'll pick at random a politician, AOC. Let's say she puts like a new piece of legislation out. I will find about it pretty quick. Yeah. Maybe she'll tweet about it or something, but I could get a notification that it happened in the app.
Exactly.
And as it passes through different phases, I can get notifications that that's happening.
Yep, any bill that you're following, there's a bill tracker, so it shows you if it just got, once it gets introduced and it makes its way to the House, to the Senate, to the President, you get notified all the way through. So.
And I like too that, I mean, your goal is to provide reliable, objective information, but you also have sort of similar to, there's guides before ballot initiatives pass, and you can get information. What does the right say the goal is here? What does the left say the goal is here? And so you can get multiple perspectives, and I think that's an awesome inclusion as well.
Exactly, I agree.
Let me ask you this. We are launching into an election right now. If everything goes well, the app is successful. What impact would you like Politiscope to have on the 2020 election?
I mean, I would like it to have, you know, a major impact. Just everybody, you know, being able to go to the app, either, you know, registering to vote if they haven't voted, register to vote, or just going to it right before they go, you know, and vote and look at the ballots and can see the politician breakdowns that we're going to, the update we're going to release once we get closer to election. But just seeing, you know, any politician you pick that's up, you know, you can see right down the middle, kind of like a boxing scorecard, like, you know, okay, they're for this, they're against this, and really can be more informed, be like, because you already know, when you're going in to vote and just the ballots, people just, they feel like they're going into a freaking SAT test, you know what I'm saying? They're just like, what the hell is this? So it's like, we're just really just trying to make it easier, because there's no reason why this shouldn't be easy, you know, so.
Yeah, and the great thing too is that, like, before an election, you know, a voter guide might come out or something like that. But who wants to, like, I'm the sort of nerd that me and my girlfriend are friends, we had a party where we got together and we went through the voter guide, learned about everything. But not everybody wants to cram before an election. Imagine just keeping up every day, every week, having that information in a way that's reliable and trustworthy. I think that that's an awesome addition to our political conversation, especially considering how much fake news and misinformation and all of that is out there.
Agreed. And we're just trying to make it just easy for the average person like me, because I'm coming from a naive perspective as well. So I'm trying to, me and Jay work hand in hand trying to just make it perfect, because, you know, I'm like, what would I want to see in this? And Jay just giving his political just input. I mean, it just works perfect, just from the pedestrian level all the way to the expert level. Mm-hmm. We just a perfect match, and I love it.
Yeah, and like you say, you can get sort of just, you go in, watch a few videos about a topic, or you can follow super in-depth on particular bills. So it really can be tailored to your needs, and so that's good as well. Thank you so much for joining us. We're really excited for both getting to talk to you about it, but also the future of the app.
I appreciate it, thank you.
Thank you.
Download Politiscope. Thank you.
Good plug. We're gonna take one more break. When we come back, let's actually talk more about misinformation. What role could political trolls play in the Democratic primary in 2020? We'll break that down after this. Welcome back. A little bit more to get to with what remains of the hour. Let's turn now to the primary. New reports coming out showing that troll farms of various sorts are spooling up for the Democratic primary, already launching coordinated attacks against a variety of different candidates, actually of both the progressive and more centrist variety. And obviously with these sorts of things, it's difficult to know exactly who is coordinating or funding these things. There's no accusations at this point that I know of that this is an international thing. Mm-hmm. It's entirely possible this is domestic. And we've seen that in prior elections too. But already in the primary, as early as it is, we've seen Elizabeth Warren had a coordinated attack implying that she had a racist object in the background of a video. Yep. That was, of course, not true. But despite the fact that it was debunked, Tommy Lahren tweeted about it after it was debunked because it's convenient to believe that she's a racist. Let's see, Beto O'Rourke recorded a racist voicemail in the 90s. I mean, he didn't. But lots of people believe that he did now. And Kamala Harris lied about smoking pot while listening to certain types of music. The hosts of the show have since debunked that she was not actually answering the question. It was alleged that she was. But who cares? It's already out there. Everybody believes it. So we're like in the first week of this thing. Already it's big.
Not ready for 2020.
No.
Like emotionally not there yet. Mm-hmm. But I will say, I think it's going to be interesting to see how some of the candidates handle dealing with each other. Like not the racist stuff, the stuff that can be obviously fact checked, but the rumor mill, right? If this is an easy attack on Kamala or this is an easy attack on Bernie, are these troll farms then going to be trying to incite base voters against that? And I have fallen into it too. It's like a whole big thing online about who was doing what on the State of the Union response, and you can get very emotional and wrapped up in that type of conversation. I'm like, oh, did I just get baited into this?
It's hard to know.
Yeah.
And that's what makes it complicated. I mean, I think there can be a thing where some people, it's hard to know exactly how serious they're being, but people love to throw around accusations of particular accounts being trolls. Mm-hmm. Or, I mean, trolls, you can just call them a troll if you want to. But whether they're a bot or not is a different sort of thing.
Yeah, I think an egg is an egg. If you can't put your face out there, you're an egg.
Yeah, but there are people who believe all sorts of rational and irrational things, so we can't assume that this is a computer program.
But we do know, and we know some of this from the Russia investigation, that is part of what was being exploited, that these are already feelings and sentiments that people have, but when you increase the amount of it and aggregate it, it can then bubble and balloon and become far more extreme a reaction. Yeah. So that's also something just to be aware of as we're all trying to get fact check and information and be accurate and be rational about this election going forward.
Yeah.
We just need to be rational because any of these candidates are gonna be better than Trump.
I agree. I mean, it is possible someone could declare that I would not support. I find that hard to believe.
Yeah, it's pretty.
I drove past tons of people I would support in the next election just this morning. I have an open mind. I don't have an empty mind, but I have an open mind.
Yes, I'm with you.
But I can't conceive of someone who I probably would not support.
And it's less, please, please. I think we all have to not relitigate 2016 primary. That's not what this is about. It's going to be a beautiful thing to have all of these candidates debating on stage and really honing what the values and principles should be of the Democratic Party. Let's embrace it. Mm-hmm. You know, the Republicans did that and they got the White House. So having 12 or 15 candidates is not going to be our problem.
Yeah, and if you want to talk about primaries, we're going to have like 15 years of the 2020 primary. Mm-hmm. We're going to have 12 debates over the course of a year. We're going to have endless primaries and caucuses and all of that. There's going to be a lot to delve into there. What does your gut say? How big will sort of coordinated attacks, bot networks and things like that? Do you think that they have the possibility of being important in the primary, or will they just be sort of a fly, buzzing around your head?
No, I think this is the modern version of the robocalls that we saw in South Carolina against John McCain for the fact that he had they said he had an out-of-wedlock black daughter when he'd actually adopted a dark-skinned Bangladeshi girl.
Yeah.
And so I think this is the modern version of that. Instead of it being on the phone and coming to your phone line, it's going to be coming to your phone via Twitter and via other digital mediums. So we just have to be prepared for the fact that the id is going to play large in this campaign on the Republican side and unfortunately on the Democratic side as well. Yeah. So let's not fall into our id.
Yeah, no. Comparing it actually to the robocalls, I think is very, very smart. My advice, and it doesn't just apply to this; it applies to almost everything. Twitter can be fun.
Yeah.
It can be
Facebook
good.
Facebook can be fun.
They can be productive. What they are not is representative.
Yes.
Of literally anything. First of all, we create our own bubbles. But even if we weren't actively doing that, the more extreme voices tend to get amplified in terms of likes and retweets. And by extreme, I don't just mean things that I disagree with, even things that I extremely agree with. Things that I say are more likely to be retweeted if they're more, you know, like, So just understand that the things you're seeing aren't necessarily representative of everything that's going on, both in terms of the fact that the person saying the message might not be a literal human being, but also that if you feel like, man, lots of people agree with me, why doesn't everyone that I see in my day-to-day life agree with me? Understand that to some extent we're self-selecting, or thinking that everyone who disagrees with me is a crazy a-hole. Well, not necessarily, just sometimes
you actually,
the online ones.
You actually might like them in person. You actually might find some common ground in person that you're not finding because you're limited to a certain number of characters on Twitter. And again, note that I've taken for myself after the last couple of weeks and just seeing how the primary is going.
We unfortunately do have to cut, but we'll talk more in the near future. Thank you so much for joining us.
Great to be here. Thank you. Thanks, everyone.
Thank you, everybody, for watching. We'll be back tomorrow to close out the week. Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.